My castaway this week is a writer, the famous son of a famous father. He left Oxford with a first and wrote his first novel, The Rachel Papers, at the age of 24, promptly winning the Somerset Maugham Award for his efforts. He seems to attract envy and admiration in equal measure. His books, which include Money, London Fields and Time's Arrow, have been highly acclaimed, and he's been called the cleverest and most entertaining writer of his generation. Personally, however, he's attracted criticism. As a result, he's dismissed the way the press have treated this aspect of his life as immoral, corrupt and arrogant. Cool, witty and 47, writing is of overwhelming importance to him. Life alone does not offer enough, he says. It can only be redeemed by being reprocessed into prose. He is Martin Amis. Is writing then, Martin, a compensation? Does your fiction make up for shortcomings in your reality?
I don't think so, because when I started writing, it was not out of any conflict. It was more out of a sense of play and wanting to join the dance. What is being redeemed is the formlessness of life. It would be intolerable to me to just be a passive liver of my life. It's only when you write that you can impose form and pattern and humour, comedy. Otherwise, the stuff itself would strike me as unendurably thin.
But does it matter, then, whether your life is going well or going badly? Does the one or the other have an effect on how much you want to write?
No, it's a fairly constant daily urge.
So do you walk with a spring in your step to your study every morning, do you? You really want to get in there?
I really want to get in there and will snarl with loathing sometimes when the telephone rings. And really, you're very intensely concentrated. And
which is apparently not how it was for your father, Kingsley Amis.
Well, Dad had daily anxiety about writing. I only have anxiety as I'm finishing a novel, where all the anxiety that's I've been sublimating comes and seeks me out.
But why my father, is that? Because people are then going to see it. You've got to let it go, as it were.
Yeah, well, it's all doubt. Doubt is what you're dealing with. And that's what my father dealt with every morning. He would be trembling over his boiled egg because he thought he'd lost it. He'd lost the magic, the knack. And then when I lived at home, I'd hear him go into his study and 15 minutes later I could hear him laughing.
But when you saw all that going on as a boy, you saw your father going through all of that, did you think then, that's what I want to do? Or did it look so awful you thought that's what I don't want to do?
What it looks like is it looks dull. Nothing is duller than what your father does for a living, whatever it is.
So it was essentially unglamorous.
Unglamorous, but glamorous too. I mean, no question about it.
Because he had status. You must have spotted that as a boy.
He had status. Things were happening. It was... I mean, what it meant for me was that my father sort of disappeared a lot of the time and was alone. And then every couple of years, he would be in the papers. And when his marriage broke up, it was in the papers. And I think I got a sense then, luckily, that that was part of the job too. Mm. And so that one had to grow another layer of skin to deal with that.
Tell me about your first record.
This is Night Train, Oscar Peterson. And part of the reason I'm so fond of it is that my next book, a short novel, is also called Night Train. And it was a kind of a rhythm in the back of my head as I was writing this short novel.
Night Train, played by the Oscar Peterson Trio, Peterson on piano, Ray Brown on bass and Ed Thigpen on drums. Martin Amis, you use a lot of your own experiences as material for your novels. If you went under a bus tomorrow, if your children then read your work, to find out more about you. They might say to themselves, I wonder why Dad was so often preoccupied with low life, with things violent or vile or humiliating.
Yes, I think they might think that. I also think they'd think that I was there in search of curious kinds of humour and even strange poetic effects as well. What I hope they'd eventually conclude is that looking around, reading around, they'd see that, in fact, all the other genres have disappeared and all we've really got left now is comedy. You know, tragedy and epic and romance don't seem to fit the world we're in at the moment.
But why, really the question is, why have you chosen as your genre, or why has your genre become unpleasant, low-life characters?
Well, yes, but they're charming, too. And the lower they are, you know, it seems in my work, the more popular they are with my readers.
But that's not the reason you write about them, surely? It's not yes, quite as cynical as that, is it?
No, there's nothing cynical about it at all. In fact, it's not even a choice. It's a recognition.
Of what?
Of you recognise what your subject is, what you are sent down here to write about.
You said something like that. You said, let me quote you to yourself, if I may. I don't come at these people, they come at me like information formed in the night. Why does such people as Keith Tallant in London Fields is the obvious example, you know, who's pretty amoral. Why does he come to you in the night and say, write about me?
It's very mysterious. I think everyone who isn't a writer has a kind of utilitarian view of how novels get written. In fact, they come from nowhere and they feel like a little gulp in your digestive system, and you just recognize that that's your next novel. What you're given in these little pangs of conception can sometimes appall you. You think, I'm going to spend 4 years on someone like that.
But what you have said, I think, on occasions is that, you know, you're not necessarily approving of these people. Obviously, you're laughing at them quite often.
That's right.
There is a comedy there. That's very difficult, I think. I mean, reading is a subjective business, but it's very difficult to accept that. You can come out of the end of some of your novels, like Money, just feeling, you know, disturbed, dejected, a bit dirty, actually.
Well, I'm sorry to hear you say that. I think that good stuff, good literature, is incapable of depressing anyone. Otherwise, there would just be a bloodbath in the theatre at the end of King Lear or Hamlet, and that doesn't happen. You come out exhilarated. Catharsis has taken place. Anything that's any good is going to cheer you up, no matter what it's about.
Tell me about record number two.
This takes me back to my days on high heels and flares and flower shirts. It's Jimi Hendrix, the live version of Voodoo Child.
I'm a voodoo child. Lord, I'm a voodoo child.
Jimi Hendrix and the live version of Voodoo Child. Going back to your early life, Martin, you apparently went to more than a dozen schools. Why so many?
Because my parents moved around and also broke up. So starting a new school became an almost annual event. And I think it made me rather obsequious and ingratiating child. I was in any case a middle child with very expressive brother and sister. So I was always picking up the pieces and being a diplomat and actually avoiding attention. It always puzzles me when I hear about children needing attention, because I always quite liked escaping from attention. And that perhaps is the seed of wanting to be a writer, is that you get all this time alone.
But you weren't into reading much, as they say. Apparently all you read was Harold Robbins and comics.
Yes, I read a lot of comics, and then I reread those comics and read Harold Robbins and things that were meant to be sexy, like John Brain, Room at the Top. That was under my bed for a year or two when I was 12 or 13. My education really became a mess. In my late teens, I was averaging about an O-level a year and spending a lot of time in betting shops and that kind of thing.
So you were quite streetwise then. Really?
Yes,
that's where it all began.
Yes, that's where it all began. And it was my stepmother, Elizabeth Jane Howard, in fact, who saw that this couldn't go on and decided to systematize my education. And I was then sent off to a boarding crammer in Brighton.
But how did they persuade you to do that? Apparently they took you out, she and your father, to a Wheeler's restaurant and said, now, this is what we're going to do with you.
They read the Riot Act, but I was ready. If you're at all bright and you're living a kind of worthless life, then you're ready for a change, and you know this can't go on. And you're more and more frightened of the world you're going to have to enter.
How old would you have been then when they did this?
Oh, quite, getting on. I mean, 18. Almost a lost cause.
And yet, within a matter of, 18 months, 2 years, you'd got into Oxford to read English.
In a year, in fact. Because I found, I liked it and was good at it.
Record number 3.
As you'll see by the end of this programme, I'm really a very sentimental soul. Beneath this exterior, as Kurt Vonnegut said, I'm as soft as a sneaker full of slime. There's a terrible sentimentality trying to get out, and the books, in a sense, are just sort of tough talk to keep that sentimentality at bay.
And this music mirrors exactly that.
Yes, if the carapace cracks, this is what you get.
Of the last movement of Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6 in B minor, the Pathétique, with the London Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Mstislav Rostropovich. So you got a first, Martin Amis, from Exeter College, but you were so laid back about it, apparently, that you didn't bother to open the envelope that told you.
Now, this is a story my father told where he accused me of being a monster of cool. It's true that when the notification came, I left the card on the kitchen table with a coffee stain on the corner of it. But that's not, it's not an accurate story, because I already knew, because I'd been to Oxford and had the interview. And this was no mere ordinary first. This was what they used to call a congratulatory first. So I knew that I'd got that, because instead of grilling you, they just chat to you for 5 minutes.
But he quite liked your cool, your father, didn't he? He rather admired your street cred, didn't he?
Well, I think he did and he didn't. I think one of the reasons he didn't like my fiction much was the milieu. I mean, he didn't like these Burkes and Louts and promiscuous young people. So that's really as far as
it's quite a good line, though, he came out with when he said that he longed when he read your books for an ordinary sentence, like they finished their drinks and left.
Well, to which I say, I want fewer of those sentences in his books. although, I mean, I never made any secret of my admiration for his work.
Anyway, you went into journalism at first. You went to the Times Literary Supplement, you went on to the New Statesman, where you were literary editor, but by 24 you'd published this first novel, the Rachel Papers, which was very successful. Was it then only a matter of time before you were going to become a full-time writer? Was that always the plot?
The plot was that I would I came down from Oxford, and I was going to have a year in London and see how it went. If I didn't fancy it, I was going to go back and do another degree, and I think I would have become an academic. But it did go well. I loved working at the TLS. I wrote my first novel in the evenings. I had a tremendous amount of energy because I'd worked so hard for my degree at Oxford. I mean, I wasn't cool about that. I'd have looked like an idiot if I hadn't got a first. I worked so hard. And working hard gives you muscles for working hard.
But then it was, you know, round about then that this whole press thing started, really. You started being called a super brat, didn't you? Because you were being so successful. Smarty Marty, they called you and so on.
Yes, except all that. I mean, in the culture generally, that it wasn't there. I mean, you delivered your novel, it got published, it got reviewed, and that was that. There was none of this secondary, you know, continuous rumble of personality stuff.
Well, why, then, it's now happened to you, why have you called it, you know, you've come on very strong about it, why have you called it immoral and corrupt?
I think I was talking about the way journalism is going. I think it is, it's getting more powerful, therefore more corrupt, and more arrogant, and more scurrilous.
But you've smarted from it personally. I mean, you can tell that.
I've
smarted from it personally.
Not that much. I mean, I think when people say, doesn't it bother you, what I take to mean being bothered by this kind of thing is that your mind is not at rest. You're constantly turning over a sense of injustice in your mind. You're waking up in the middle of the night murdering people in your thoughts. And honestly, that hasn't happened. Every now and then, someone says something that does get under your skin, but it's not the volume of the stuff that does it. I haven't really felt cowed by that.
Record number 4.
This is a song that's true and beautiful for the 2 minutes of its duration. James Brown, It's a Man's World.
Made me the cars to take us over the road. Made me the train to carry the heavy load. Made me the electrolyte to take us out of the dark. Made me the boat for the water.
James Brown and It's a Man's World. And now, Martin Amis, you have 2 daughters.
That's right. Separated by 2 decades. The elder, Delilah Seal, I've only come to know in the last couple of years, and the younger, Fernanda, who's just recently joined us.
I said earlier that you used your life as material for your fiction. Was your daughter, Delilah, always there in it then? Delilah, we should explain, you fathered during a brief affair in the 70s and have recently been reunited, as it were. She's 20 years old. I noted in Money, you've got the hero there, John Self, saying at one point, should you ever find yourself in a paternity or maternity mix-up, tell the kid. How can you live seriously if you don't know who you are? I mean, was that your thoughts about Delilah there?
Well, the writer Maureen Freely wrote an interesting piece where she said that this had become a theme in my work around about the time that Delilah was being born and raised, you know, outside my ken. I knew of her, but I didn't. And I had fantasies of following the pram around, but she was in another life, and she ought to have remained close to me. And it's true, if you look at my books, there are these missing children. Also, my cousin, first cousin, Lucy Partington, disappeared at that time, and as we later discovered, was one of Fred West's victims. But for 20 years, she was just someone who had disappeared.
And she's there. It's said in your novel, there's Mary Lamb, isn't there?
Yes, there are these...
And other people. And
there's this great anxiety in my novels about children disappearing. I wasn't consciously writing about Lucy or Delilah, but of course, fiction is where your unconscious asserts itself. And, of course, I had been worrying about them. They'd been in the back of my mind. And the novel is exactly the place where that kind of hidden preoccupation is going to surface.
So art imitates life in that sense. Does life ever imitate art? It was said that when you began writing The Information, which is about a midlife crisis, you weren't having one, but by the time you finished it, you were.
That's true. But the novel was in that limbo between being finished and being published when the great fuss happened. So it didn't affect the book. The book evolved into a kind of midlife crisis, although that was always going to be its subject.
Okay, well, we'll talk about the great fuss in a minute, but just let's pause and have some more music.
Ben Webster and Coleman Hawkins are what I spend 90% of my music listening time with, and it's always been my theory that all sax music is seduction. This would be the brisk way of trying to seduce a woman.
Ben Webster Quintet and Late Date, with Ben Webster on sax, Oscar Peterson on piano, Ray Brown on bass, Herb Ellis on guitar and Stan Levy on drums. That was recorded in 1957. And I was just saying, it's a very jaunty seduction there.
Yes, you're trying to jolly them along before they have a chance to think about it.
So this very public midlife crisis, we all knew about it. Your marriage broke up. There was a row about your wanting too much money for your book. You lost your agent of long standing and you spent £20,000 on your teeth. It was incredibly public, all played out in the newspapers. How painful was it?
Well, it was nothing compared to what was actually going on. What happened in the papers was just a pinprick compared to the actual events.
Tell me a bit about the money thing, because apparently you'd never bothered about money before. You'd always, I read, put your bank statements in a shoebox unopened.
I've gone back to that now. I suppose it was just curiosity about, you know, wanting to, you reached a certain stage in your life and you wanted to know where you stood.
What you were worth or what you could get, do you mean?
Well, what a publisher was prepared to pay.
Had you not bothered that much before that? You'd just taken vaguely what the agent negotiated?
Yes, I hadn't bothered much. I'm not, you know, interested in money, not excited by it. But there was this, it was part of the sort of convulsion in my life that I wanted to, you know, I kept seeing that I was supposed to be the most influential, etc., writer of my generation. So I thought, well, let's test the waters. And it wasn't, I mean, it was exaggerated so as a, not exaggerated, but seized on as a way of having another reason to attack me, because there were other advances paid that were within a stone's throw of that that caused not even a business paragraph.
But this caused you to lose your agent, Pat Kavanagh, and thereby her husband, your friend Julian Barnes. You know, it all got sort of terribly personal and painful, presumably.
Mm. Yes, it did.
And why did you let that happen, is really what I'm asking.
Well, I don't know if... I mean, perhaps the press does here become a kind of an actor in the drama, because by the time that happened, I felt I'd long lost control of events. And it's... I mean, the press really created a lot of the pressure that made that happen.
Is it... over, I mean, is the big midlife crisis
I'm
over?
Through it now,
You're hardened.
Yes.
Battle-scarred.
Well, you do, I mean, a crisis is exactly what it is. In the information, I suggest that it's an hysterical overreaction to the clear fact that you're going to die, that all this is finite, and that you're, as Larkin said, it's not only going to happen, but it's so near. But a crisis is a crisis, and it has a beginning and an end, and you do come up the other side of the midlife crisis. And you look around, you think, well, I've still got one arm, and this, I've still got this leg. And actually, your horizons are clearer to you, and you're strengthened and emboldened by having made this, you know, jump into the next bit of life that seemed so strange to you when you entered it.
Record number 6.
This is the beginning of Handel's Concerto No. 4 in A minor from his Concerti Grossi. It's beautifully mathematical. ¶¶
The opening of Handel's Concerto No. 4 in A minor from his Concerti Grossi Opus 6, played by the English Concert Orchestra, conducted by Trevor Pinnock. Does, Martin, being over your midlife crisis mean that you've ceased to contemplate death, or is it something that still daily invades your thoughts?
As Saul Bellow said, it's like the dark backing behind a mirror that you need before anything can be seen. You know, the mirror wouldn't work without this sheet of darkness behind it.
But how much do you think about it?
Not much. I'm certainly not like my father, who, and like Philip Larkin, who probably had something that there is now a name for, like early death awareness syndrome. It doesn't loom for me as it did for him. And it was almost, you know, pathological with him. He would, as a child, I remember, sometimes my mother would wake me up and bring my father into my room, and he would just chat for a few minutes and then go back. And I said, "What was that about last night?" And she said, "Well, he'd woken up with a nightmare, and he knew that if he was with you, he had to be calm." And I think, it really was a terror for him, and it certainly hasn't been that way for me.
And how has his death affected you? I mean, obviously, it would makes any child think about their own mortality. But you said something slightly odd. You said that, I mean, obviously, you're very saddened by his death, but you said also that it's been liberating, that a great obstacle has gone. What
it's
do you
as
mean
if,
by
well,
that?
It's many things. And, as psychologists say, death is not a simple thing. It's the complex symbol. If you're honest, you'll say that as your father's death is happening, you feel very energetic. The body feels important because it is about to be promoted into the front line, temporal front line. So Freud said that he had a huge attack of energy when his father died, because you also feel you've got to get stuff done because your death is now more present to you because the intercessionary figure of your father has gone. And that kind of gets you through it, too. And then, as someone said to me, it's the simple expressions of grief that actually are the truest ones. Someone said, it's like losing a part of yourself, and, you don't get over that. And that's what it was like.
But it also means that you cease to be the boy and become the man, to put it simplistically.
Well, yes, if to deal with the sort of media 1% of the whole question, I can't, surely to God, go on being the bad boy of English letters as I approach my 50s. I think I was the bad boy for so long simply because the bad man was there. And now that the man is gone, then surely I go from boy to man, I would have thought.
Record number 7.
This is Oscar Peterson again, Georgia on My Mind.
The Oscar Peterson Trio again, this time with Georgia on My Mind. How much, Martin, do you care about your readers, or don't you care about them beyond the fact that they're there?
No, I feel passionately about my readers. I think reading is an art, just as writing is. Every reader will take something different away from your books. Every reader will have a different view of each of your characters, will paint them in their own mind. I feel, more and more that one needs the support of one's readers.
But, obviously you hope, all authors hope, that they will live on after their death. You have Richard Tull, the unsuccessful one of the two novelists in The Information, worrying that the awful superficial work of his rival will live on. And he says, if it did, the universe would be a joke, an awful contemptible joke. Mm. Do you fear, then, for your readers that poor literature does them harm?
No, I think any reading is better than no reading. Because what's so important about reading is that you're communing with another mind.
But you despise, don't you, people who attempt to get the reader to identify with them. That's not what you want. You think that's pretty cheap, don't you?
Well, Nabokov said that the number one on your list of what not to do as a reader is identify with the main character, with, you know, Anna or Vronsky. What you should be doing is identifying with the author and seeing what he or she is up to and how they're arranging things and trying to get an overview of the novel, not being swept along helplessly by a kind of soap opera.
But the possibility that Geoffrey Archer's oeuvre may outlive your own is pretty hard to stomach, is it?
Well, my father used to say, you know, he didn't care at all about posterity because he wouldn't be around to enjoy its good opinion. And, you know, no bloody use to me, he used to say. But I know he did mind a little bit. It's what keeps writers honest, because it's all that matters, being read after you're dead. And by definition, you're never going to know whether it's... You know, that's an absolute lock. They've got you there. So it keeps you honest to know that the big question is one you won't even get a glimpse of.
Last record.
This is Coleman Hawkins' Yesterdays, and this is the rather more whiny and wheedly way of trying to seduce someone, but with great complexity and feeling.
Yesterdays, recorded in 1950 with Coleman Hawkins on tenor sax, Hank Jones on piano, Ray Brown on bass and Buddy Rich on drums. There's a lot of seduction on this island considering you're all alone, Martin.
Yes, that's true.
Are you going to survive on your own?
I think I would. I mean, I'd miss my sons and my daughters. But I want to find the writer as he or she is most alive when alone. And there's definitely some truth in there. So I wouldn't be throwing myself to the sharks.
If you could only take one of those records, which one would it be?
Well, I think the last one. It has a kind of abrasive complexity and never quite answers the questions that it's posing.
And your book?
My book would be the Longman's annotated Milton. If it can't be a collected works of, then it would just be Paradise Lost.
And what about your luxury?
Well, cable TV. If I had to just take a few channels, then I'm afraid they would be the sports channels. I know you can't say that without everyone thinking you're laddish, whatever that means, but I'm afraid I do get an awful lot of pleasure watching tennis and football and other sports on television.
Martin Amis, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Pleasure. Thank you.